Hello and welcome to Kitchen Curiosity. I'm your host, Radford Chancellor. On the 8th episode of this show, we're back in London. And can I say, can you believe we're on the 8th episode already? We're recording in our brand new studios at Canary Wharf. And today I'm joined by the chef director of Caprice Holdings, who oversees the food operations at some of London's most prestigious restaurants, including Caprice, Sexy Fish, Scots in Richmond, and Scots in Mayfair. He joined our industry at the age of 16 when he worked for some amazing venues, including Marco Pierre White's Harvey's, along with Gordon Ramsay. He's been a judge of the Observer Food Monthly Award and was instrumental in winning the Craft Guild of Chefs New Restaurant Award for Scots Mayfair. He's been awarded the Achievement Award at the CHS Awards, just to name a few of his accolades. It's a privilege to welcome Tim Hughes, Chef Director of Caprice Holdings, to the show. Tim, thank you for taking the time to be with me today. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Great. Well, as tradition of this show, the guest of the last show asks the question to the guest of the next show. And you may or may not know, but previously we had Sophie Higham on, who's a chef from Midlands. And her question to you was, how do you come up with the sort of concepts and ideas and the culinary visions for the brands you look after?
Well, that's quite a tricky question, that, because some of our original restaurants have been like very old established restaurants that have been closed, and then we've reopened, taking example of Jay Shiki.
Right.
When we reopened Jay Shiki, we did a lot of research of the fish restaurant, and we thought, okay, some of that cuisine there's a bit old, a bit laboured. How can we modernise it? We take the essence of what the restaurant was and brought it back to life, but also modernize it, because everyone these days, you know, they travel a lot, they have a lot of different tastes, and you have to always be relevant and come up with new ideas, but also keep sort of like the history of an old lady like Jay Shiki's was.
Right, okay.
It was like one of the most famous fish restaurants in London.
Yeah. So you're trying to sympathise with the venue that you've got, but also keeping up to
exactly keeping it modern, keeping it relevant, but also keep tradition. You know, if you had somewhere like Jay Shiki, which was the theatre restaurant of London, I mean, all the panels, all the pictures in the restaurants were like pictures of people on the stage. You know,
right, okay.
You'd have Stanley Baxter, you'd have the Redgraves, you'd have, you know, even Peter Sellers dressed up as Queen Victoria, you know.
Wow.
So it was like brilliant.
Okay.
And you'd have all some of the old people coming, like Michael Gambon said, oh God, look at that picture of me there. I was so young and handsome then.
Yeah.
So you try to keep it all traditional.
Right. Okay.
But also modernize it. I mean, someone said to me, you can't reinvent the wheel, but you can put a new tire on it. And that's what we try to do.
That's what you're doing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, I've got to get out of the way, because obviously it's the big name that everyone knows, the Sexy Fish. How did that brand come around?
Well, that was from my owner, Richard Caring.
Right.
You know, he loved that style of Asian cuisine. And he came up with this name, which we were all a bit shocked by at the time.
Right,
and
he said,
no, it's a great name. You know, everyone's going to remember it. And, you know, he was right, because everyone did remember it. We were a bit nervous about the name, but the thing is, now everyone knows Sexy Fish. When you say Sexy Fish, oh yeah, yeah, I know Sexy Fish.
Yeah, of course.
So
yeah.
In that way, it's a name that people always remember.
Yeah, yeah, it's a different name.
Yeah, where if you get some restaurants and you can't remember their name because they're just not very rememberable.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. So, I mean, can you share with our listeners how you got started in the culinary world, and kind of what was your initial motivation, inspiration to get into the sector?
Yeah, people say, yeah. I mean, I didn't have a romantic grandmother or mother that was a beautiful cook. My mother couldn't cook at all. I think basically I had to go out and try to cook, you know, get something decent to eat. I was a 16-year-old. It was the early 80s, the Maggie Thatcher era of, you know, unemployment pretty high, but the saving grace was that there was apprenticeships, which were everywhere. And me, my friends were all from school. When we left school, we didn't really have much jobs. We didn't really know what jobs we were going to go into. So we'd go down the job centre. have a look. And the job centre in those days, they would encourage you to go for work. I don't know what it's like now. Mm-hmm. And I saw there was this advertisement for an apprentice chef. I always said I wanted to work outdoors, and I end up being working indoors my whole life now.
Right.
And I saw it, apprenticeship, so I went along and had a go.
Okay.
And then sort of fell in love with it.
And there you go, that's where you got into the culinary
exactly,
world.
Exactly, that's how I got into it.
And how long have you been with Caprice?
Caprice Holdings, I've been, this will be my 26th year now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
But I did leave a couple of times and came back.
So, yeah.
But this is 26 years non-stop now.
So kind of following the introduction into the sort of culinary world, who are your sort of biggest influences? I know that we touched downstairs, you know. Gordon Ramsay, you've been fishing with him, you said. I mean, who are your biggest influences in our sector?
Well, I think when I had my apprenticeship, there was an old Swiss chef. He looked exactly like the little French guy from Ratatouille, big belly, tall chef hat, moustache, very thick French accent. He sort of got me into the cooking. Where we were, the food wasn't that great, but he took me on the side and showed me the proper way of doing a dish, a sauce, or stuff like this. And then he got me to go to Switzerland. I went to Switzerland. That was great. And then came to London. And then I met Gordon Ramsay, and he said, oh, I'm working at Marco Pierre White. So I went there.
Right.
And that was in the early days.
Okay.
That was when Marco only had one star.
Yeah.
In thing. And I think that's where he suddenly kicked me in the teeth in a way of this food is like second to none. What Marco was doing in those days was unbelievable.
Right.
And the chefs from all over the world had to go to Marco to eat because there was no Instagram.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no social media like we have now. And I'd say Marco really, really did
sort of set the standard.
For me. And then after that, when I became a head chef, got out of that Michelin mode, I then worked for Chris Corbin and Jeremy King.
Okay.
Which showed me another side. You can't just be a chef. You've got to think of the bigger picture.
Right.
Service point of view, customer.
Business,
yeah. Staff, everything.
Everything, yeah.
Yeah. So those two are probably the two. Well, those three people are probably the biggest influences.
Okay. For me. Are you still friends with Gordon now? Or
Yeah. We meet up, but, you know, when he comes to eat, I have to peel his longestine for him. It's gone too soft as a chef, I think.
So what's a typical day look like as chef director of the group? And how do you balance up between sort of administration and creative aspects of your role?
Well, in the morning, I wake up, I see all the reports from all the restaurants, so I have a look at those, see if there's been any issues with service, food.
Right.
If there's been a food problem, I phone the site or text them what went wrong last night.
Right.
And I tend to go into Mayfair, to Scott's in Mayfair, phone all the chefs, see if everything's okay. I'm very lucky. I have a lot of loyal chefs, head chefs, that stay with me for a long time.
Yeah.
And I trust them to run the businesses.
Right.
And we have a very good rapport. We meet up. We have a chef meeting. We have tastings in each site every 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Wow, okay.
But we only change certain dishes, quite seasonal.
Yeah.
I look at staff problems. If there's staff issues they've got, and if they're short of staff here or they want promotions. I like to be in the kitchen, so I like to know
what's
all
going
the chef's
on.
Names.
Yeah.
Because when they come to me with a problem with someone, I need to know that I know that person.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
How many head chefs are there in the group?
Well, I have a head chef in each site. So, so there's seven head chefs.
Right.
Sexy Fish is taken care of by Bjorn.
Right.
So that's his arm of that one now.
Okay. Both sides.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. What are some of the current trends of culinary world that have captivated you? And kind of how do you see the restaurant industry evolving in the next few years?
Oh, it's a tricky one. I think, I'm of a certain age now and I see all these younger chefs coming in and they have a lot more, they have a different vision to what I have.
Mm.
So probably I was the same when I was young. And I think you're always learning off these everybody, and some of the new chefs and new ideas are fantastic. I think as a chef, you never stop learning. You think you don't, but you're always learning. And
it's evolving all the time.
Yes, all the time. And the inferences from different techniques, like if you're taking Japanese techniques and mixing it with classical French cuisine,
it all relates
to each other. And some of these techniques, I think, are fantastic, you know, and we use a lot of those now. You know, we modernize the way we cook.
Yeah.
And also what people want to eat.
Of course, of course. And I mean, how do you see things evolving, really, in do you think it will just keep evolving as it is, or do you think there's anything radical coming?
I think things evolve all the time, but then they also go back to the old types of cuisine.
Yeah.
And like I said before, they just put a new tar on it. They modernize it. Mm. But the fundamental bit of that cuisine is still classical.
Yeah, of course.
Which I don't think you should ever lose.
Yeah.
So everything does evolve. And I think it's better for the techniques in the kitchen as well, because you don't want to be like in the old days where there was so much stress. The kitchens were so hot. And when you talk to Trevor later on, you know, his cooking equipment, you know, you're trying to create a better atmosphere within a kitchen.
Working environment for staff.
You have to.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, our biggest issue is finding staff, and you have to take care of them.
And retaining them.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Very much so. Kind of leads me nicely on to the next question. I mean, obviously you talked to your head chefs and you've done tastings and things like that. But how do you foster sort of creativity and teamwork within your business or within the business?
I think you have to trust your teams that you know, you let them do dishes, you let them make mistakes, and they come up with an idea and you think, is that really right? Does that really work? Is it balanced on our menu?
So the culinary vision comes from the whole team,
collective,
really.
Yeah. Because I can't do it. I don't want to put a chef as a head chef and tell him what to do all the time.
Yeah.
What's the point of having that head chef?
There's no creativity.
No.
Yeah.
He needs to be creative, and I'm putting him in a job to be creative.
Mm.
You know, so I very much want them. I might not like the dish. I might not think it's too ripe, but it's not about me. It's about what the customer likes.
Yeah.
What the team like doing, you know, and if does it fit in that menu? And if it fits in the menu, then go for it. Let's try it.
Yeah.
You know, you can always change it.
Of course. Yeah.
You know.
So just thinking about people joining our industry, what advice would you give to somebody who's sort of just coming into the sector, and how important is like a formal culinary training? Obviously, you talked about you did an apprenticeship.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm at the moment actually at this time, we're interviewing a lot of now potential apprentices, and I have a big thing about apprenticeships. I think we should all do it. We should all have the apprentices.
Right, yeah.
I think 4 days in a workplace, 1 day at college, they benefit more from that than going all the time at college.
Yeah.
Because when they're doing an apprenticeship in our restaurants, after they finish the apprenticeship, they're ready to go.
Yeah.
You know, they know what it's about. They know that they can stand on their feet for 12 hours, that they know the pressure of a service. And with the apprentices, I try to do it slowly with them. You can't break them straight away. Otherwise, they go out of the industry.
Yeah.
The thing is, they have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
They have to listen. And their parents have to back them.
Right, okay.
You know, if they have a lot of that going for them, they'll do well.
Yeah.
But it is about listening, because unfortunately, we're in the media world where people can't remember anything. They can't remember an order.
Right.
You know, when we first started, there was no a system where the order came through on a machine.
Yeah, or on a screen or whatever.
A chef shouted it out, and 9 times out of 10, it was in French, and you had to remember it.
Yeah.
The first thing you did was get all the fish out or get all the meat out, then you knew what you had to do, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you have to take a lot more patience, a lot more time with people.
Yeah, of course.
Which is,
and so they kind of like doing 1 day at college and 4 days in your business.
Yeah.
Is that kind of...
Yeah, that's an apprenticeship, and then when they're not at college, they... 5 days in the business.
Yeah.
So you pay for him to go to college. And all I expect from an apprentice is to go to college.
Of course, yeah.
Even if you don't like it, it's only 1 day of your life.
Yeah, yeah, and get that formal...
Get that certificate, because then you can go anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Because if you go to America or places like this, you need qualifications.
Mm. I think as well for chefs, it's really important, isn't it? Because you're going to learn. Well, even when I went to college, you know, you come out of college and you know nothing.
Mm.
You peel potatoes for 2 months because
you're retraining, basically, aren't you?
Yeah, you've got to. Yeah, it's 6 months for you any good for anything. So. Yeah.
And
yeah,
every kitchen's different as well. So you might learn in one of our kitchens, and then you go to another kitchen.
Yeah.
And it's completely different.
Of course, different style, service.
Yeah, service, the way the people are, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing about kitchens is they're, or in catering in general, is the multinational. You know, you have so many different people.
Yeah.
So many, you know, cultures.
Yeah.
I think that's, in a way, when you start doing it, it gets quite addictive in a way. I mean, my eldest son's a chef.
Okay.
And when he told me he wanted to be a chef, I went, oh, no. I said, why do you want to be a chef?
He's kept in the family.
I shouldn't have said that. And then he said, well, you've got to understand, I've been around it all my life.
Yeah.
And I went, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Do you cook much at home?
Yeah, I cook all the time, yeah.
All right, okay.
Don't want to say this, but my wife likes my food better. And hers, not my son. She prefers my son's now.
Right, okay, now there's competition.
He's a better cook now, yeah. But you can't have both of us in the kitchen. It ends up being a bit of a punch up.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, exactly. I feel like that with family in the kitchen. Is there any projects coming up that you can share with us, or anything, innovations in the restaurants you'll be doing?
Yeah, we're called Caprice Holdings. So we are going to relaunch the Caprice.
Oh, okay, right.
And that's going to be an exciting project. It's going to be a challenging project because you're bringing an old lady back
to life.
Back to life into London.
Yeah, in Mayfair?
Yes. Probably. So it's okay. Going to be exciting. It's going to be an exciting time.
Yeah.
So what the concept's going to be, it'll be obviously true to what Caprice was.
Yeah.
But maybe a lot more modern.
Okay, right, okay. And that's coming up in the next couple of years or?
Yeah, probably late next year.
Right, okay. So the final question is something that I ask all my chef guests. You're hosting a dinner party for three people, famous, dead or alive. Who would you invite? What would the menu be and why?
Wow. So who do I invite? That's a tricky one. Well, I think you'd have to have Escoffier.
Right, okay.
Because he's...
It's a big name to kick us off with.
he's the modern day, you know, classical French cuisine from, you know, from what we all cook now.
Yeah.
One, I'd like to know how he came up with the ideas. Obviously, it's from before and he's modernized it. And then when you cook for him, you'd like to see if he liked it or not. You want to see his face. Yeah. I think another person, I think Steve McQueen, because he's just so cool. And he's a bit of a maverick. And I've watched a couple of documentaries on him, and I didn't know that he used to drive motorbikes for the USA motorbike team.
Okay.
Yeah, he did it in, I think there was something in East Berlin or something. And that was the time after the Cold War.
Yeah.
It was like a political thing with America and East Berlin. I don't think he won or something and then went off and did Le Mans, you know. So I'd like to, and also he was a great actor.
Yeah.
Proper macho man.
Good conversation.
Came from a sort of broken up family, you know.
Yeah.
And it would break the conversation. Who would be the third person? Now that's a tricky person, isn't it? That's a tricky one, sorry. Tricky, tricky one. Probably Marco Pierre White.
Okay. Yeah.
To have a disagreement with Escoffier or copy his dishes. Yeah.
It's a couple of big chef names there. So,
I think two chefs and a star. But they're all male, actually.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a male table.
Yeah, that's okay. And what would you be cooking?
Well, I think you'd have to start with shellfish. You know, I'd do a nice cold shellfish platter.
Right.
You know, all the langoustine.
Yeah.
Lobster, oysters. I love oysters.
Okay. It's sort
like
of fish
air. And... Yeah,
is that your
freedom
thing, what you really like to cook? Is that,
yeah, I love fish, yeah.
Right, okay.
Love freedom air. And then, I think, and then afterwards, you've got to go for beef afterwards, haven't you? The best Côte de Bœuf roasted.
Beautiful, yeah.
Good to share. All the sauces, the Béarnaise.
Probably the Béarnaise.
Yeah. And then, you know, a proper Dauphinoise. I'd have to get my wife.
This is the dinner party that I've been cooking.
I'd have to get my wife in to cook the dauphinoise though, because she always says she does the best dauphinoise, and she does a very good dauphinoise. She'd have to be in the kitchen. And then I think desserts for me would just be the fruits which are in the season.
Okay.
And a good cheese board.
Very nice. Yeah, honestly, people always in my family take the piss out of me, because you've come to my house, there'll always be beef, there'll always be dough from our potatoes. Yeah. So you've just reeled off my menu. No, classic. It sounds lovely.
Yeah. And some great wines.
That sounds great. Okay, well, thank you, Tim, for being part of this part of the show and giving me some insight into your career to date and obviously into Caprice Holdings. We're now going to take a short break, and we're going to be discussing exclusive ranges with the managing director of the firm. And then, Tim, you're going to rejoin us on the next part of the podcast.
Exclusive Ranges boasts over 25 years of industry know-how and an unparalleled record of service. Their client portfolio speaks volumes, encompassing 54 Michelin-starred restaurants, with over 200 kitchens installed and more than 3,000 cookers built. Exclusive Ranges supply some of the most prestigious hotels and restaurants across the UK. Their unwavering commitment to supplying state-of-the-art professional kitchen equipment makes them the ultimate choice in the industry. To find out more, visit exclusiveranges.co.uk.
With over 25 years of experience of supplying high-quality kitchen equipment, Exclusive Ranges is well-placed to offer game-changing technology for any commercial kitchen in today's world. With a host of esteemed brands in their portfolio, they work with designers, specifiers, distributors and chefs from Michelin-star restaurants and restaurants from mainstream food service and food production sites, all of whom expect a dedicated professional service. I'm delighted to be joined by one of my favourite people in the industry, a gentleman who heads up Exclusive Ranges and supplier of premium cooking equipment to the UK for over 28 years, providing specialised cooking suites to some of the most prestigious venues, including Caprice Holdings, Soho House, The Ritz, Michel Rouge Le Gavroche. Trevor Burke is also a member of the FEA and was voted top 100 most industry influencers. Welcome to the show today, Trevor. Thank you for taking the time to be with me. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good to see you again. Can you start by giving us a short introduction to your career in the food service sector and also the sort of work that you undertake as MD at Exclusive Ranges?
Like a lot of people, a bit like Tim, I kind of fell into the industry accidentally. I mean, left school at 16, you know, from in South London. And I actually left school to be a professional footballer.
Seriously?
Yeah.
This is something I've learned.
So my apprenticeship was at Crystal Palace.
Right.
So that was my dream. That was a dream of any young boy.
Okay.
And so I'd two fantastic years there.
Right.
With the late, great Terry Venables.
Cool.
And it was a brilliant thing to be doing as a young guy.
Right.
It did not quite work out. You know, I just didn't have enough pace, really. Quite a good player.
Yeah.
Just lacked a little bit of the final bit that you need to be a top pro. And so my contract ended, and one of the board directors at Crystal Palace had a connection with the Park Lane Hilton.
Right.
And so people falling off the edge of playing football, youngsters in particular, he helped find them work.
Okay.
In the hotel business.
Right.
And so one of his motivations was that there was a very vibrant inter-hotel football culture within London. So each big hotel had its own football team, played every week on Hyde Park, and it was a thing.
Yeah.
So he picked up quite a few ex-professionals to play in the Hilton football team. That was and that was our kind of motivation to go there. So I got a job as a food storeman.
Right.
And which was interesting, really, because a bit like Tim, you know, my mum's cooking was my mum's cooking. It was egg and chips on a Monday, pork strips on a Tuesday,
right,
and, you know, pig's trotters on a Friday. And I didn't really know anything else. So I walked into a food store with two guys from Ghana and three guys from the Seychelles who thought it was amazing that they could see this English guy and feed him loads of things that he didn't know.
No.
They'd never even seen, let alone tasted. Mm. You know, so I had a lot of things in my mouth, like chili and ginger and things that I'd never even seen. Right. And so that was my intro into food.
Okay.
And into kitchens, because we used to load up all the barras, take them up into the Park Lane kitchens. Mm-hmm. The chef would be there. They'd tick them all off. So you were wandering around a really, what was then, and still is actually, a really classic old school hotel kitchen.
Okay.
And so I had a couple of years doing that. And then I got promoted, actually, to look after the equipment in the hotel. Like a general store. So I started seeing a lot of product, like glasses, cups, saucers, knives, forks, duck presses, all the things in the hotel you were responsible for.
Yeah.
Getting into the right place, basically, into each restaurant. And that was a couple of years of that. And I had to leave after about 3 years in total there. And so I went for a job in Pages.
Oh, yeah.
Like a catering equipment showroom in Shaftesbury Avenue. Went for a job as a warehouseman.
Now in Nisbets, I think.
Now in Nisbets. And it was owned by the Chinacraft group and the Lipton family.
It's
a family business. And I went there for a job. And I thought, I wore a jacket and tie for my interview. And I thought, that's what you do, because I hadn't really been to many interviews.
Yeah.
And I met a guy called Nigel Lee, who was the manager. Posh Yorkshire.
Right.
And I said, I come to the warehouse job. And he said, you don't look like a warehouseman, young man. He said, you could do better. You could do better. And he said, but maybe you could be a salesman on the showroom.
Oh, okay.
I was like, no. I said, I don't do that stuff.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, look, hang about. The general manager's coming, but we're going to fix that.
Yeah.
And so I started off as in the glass and china department in the Pages showroom.
Right.
And a guy who ran that department, an Aussie called Chris Hillis. Honestly, people used to bring glasses into that shop from all over London and say, Chris, what is that? And he could name the glass, where it was from.
Wow,
he was an absolute expert and really a lucky break to have someone like that to learn from. And in that showroom then, you were only allowed to sell, I was only allowed to sell glass and china.
Right.
So the hierarchy was, look, when you got a bit more experience, you could sell something with a plug on it.
Right.
And then you could sell something
heavy. Right.
But you had to give the customer up.
Right.
So you weren't allowed to do it. So, and we were all commission based. So my commission number, 104, is like ingrained on your head. So every day they printed out the till roll.
Right.
Sales against your number.
Wow. Okay.
But we couldn't sell anything other than glass and china, which was low value sale. So I progressed up to selling things with a plug on, and then heavier equipment, and then they used to do Valentine fryers and Falcon six burner ranges, and it wasn't Linkat then. The Linkat of the day was Ollis. And they were a big seller in the Pages showroom, and people used to come in, walk around, pick equipment up to fit their restaurant out.
Wow. Okay.
And you know, that was like,
because there wasn't probably the internet in the same way. Like,
and people, you know, in Soho would just literally walk around for their afternoon and buy everything from a glass to a cooker and fryer.
Yeah.
And would take it away from that showroom. it was a different world. And I became assistant manager there. And it was a fantastic journey through and into the catering equipment business. And even now, I use things I learned there.
Yeah.
Definitely. About knowing about other products, about other things. And it was a great thing to do. But I was a bit restless, only because I wanted to be out on the road as a rep.
Okay.
Because I wanted a car.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, that was my aim.
And did Pages do that?
So Pages had a division where their glass and china salesmen were reps on the road.
Okay.
They were selling to big hotels, but they were traveling around
the UK or whatever.
All over the UK. Big operation. You know, they had a domestic side and a commercial side. And I harangued the owner, Gerald Lipton. And in the end, he gave in and said, yeah, okay, look, come to the head office, go and be a rep. So I went to I'll just tell you this quick story because it's My wife now will be holding her ears because she hates this story. So I went to the head office, signed up as a rep.
Yeah.
Give them the car keys of a red Sierra.
Right, okay.
Company car.
Yeah.
Drove it home.
Right.
Used to live in Southgate, so you're parking on the road and parked the car, went in the house, came out, said, company car, all good. Came out the next morning, stolen.
No, you're joking.
Stolen. And that moment, that feeling of that morning, walking up and down the road thinking, I'm sure I parked it here.
Wow.
Was and I had to go in on the tube to the showroom, back to
Pages.
It's gone. To say to the general manager, and then ring the Gerald Lipton to say the car was stolen.
Wow.
And I always remember it. He went, you're not getting another one, so you're back in that in showroom.
Yeah.
Put the phone down. And that was it. So a little bit, I mean, it was a horrible feeling. It was terrible. And so a little bit after that, I got offered a job working for Steels, WM Steel.
Right, okay.
As a rep for London.
Wow.
And that was brokered by an old boy at Pages who I was kind of working with, selling the heavy equipment, a guy called Steve Pryor, really old Polish ex-resistance, brilliant guy. And he just said to me, you're leaving. He said, we're going to lunch with the Hobart general manager.
Okay.
The Steels general manager, it was pre-Hobart.
With pre-Hobart, yeah.
And we're going to Kettner's, we're going to have lunch, and he's going to offer you a job as a rep for London. He said, and you're taking it, you need to get out of here now.
Right, okay.
And that was how I went to work for Steels.
Right.
And so that was pre-Hobart, and they were down in Hastings, and I was their London rep, and first started looking at big equipment.
Yeah.
Big cooking equipment. They imported Combis and Merino cooking, the brand Merino. Weary. And so I started...
back then as well, Hobart was like the brand, wasn't it? Everybody had...
And I worked for Steels as WM Steels for 2 years, and then Hobart bought them.
Okay.
And so we all had to go to Hobart up in Southgate, which I lived near, basically to be interviewed for our jobs as salespeople, because we were integrated into the Hobart thing.
Yeah.
And I met David Smithson, who was the MD there. And he said, right, Trevor, your future is with Hobart. And I thought, no, I don't think it is really, because I'd spoken to a guy called Bill Downey. And Bill was back from the Middle East where he'd been working. And he opened, he was going to run a company called Cairn Strands, which were going to be the Merino agent that was with Steels that Hobart didn't want.
Right, okay.
And the guy at Merino, Italian guy called Damolin, he said, there's this guy in London that sold loads of our equipment. If you're going to be the agent, Bill, you need to speak to this guy, Trevor Burke.
Yeah.
And I went to see Bill. I met him at Heathrow, and we just sat down with his wife, actually, Betty. And he just said, yeah, okay. He said, when do you want to start?
Right, okay. Yeah.
I said, is that it? He said, yeah. He said, yeah, you can start when you want. I mean, he was really, and I said, what happens if when you go back to your office, because he's been traveling, you open up all the applicants, because it was in the caterer, the ad, and you find someone you think is better. Yeah. And his wife, who was a really lovely lady, Betty, said, he won't even open them. He's decided that that's it. And that was it. I went to work for Bill, and that took me from being a guy on the road with a car selling stuff to somebody who understood about importing brands, looking after equipment, having a relationship with people in different countries.
Yeah.
Bill knew all of that. And, you know, I sat on his shoulder for like 6 years.
Right, okay.
Learning about the equipment, finding out who all the people were. So in that business, we looked after Maiko, Elro, Rorg, Merino, Frankie. It was a massive business.
Okay.
It was a brilliant business.
Yeah.
And the parent company of Cairn were bought out, and they didn't want to be in the commercial business.
Right.
Commercial kitchen. They're a domestic sink manufacturer in Scotland. And they just decided that they didn't want to be in that business. And that was the beginning of Maiko UK.
Yeah,
Bill said, right, okay. Maiko said, Bill, you know, we're going to open on our own.
Yeah.
Don't you worry. And so I had the choice of going with Bill.
To Myco.
To Myco, yeah. and starting that journey, or going on my own.
Right.
And the people, the Moreno, the family that owned Moreno, Grivaldi family, they said, look, you know, you're our guy.
Right,
we'll set you up here, and we'll open Moreno UK. And I said, wow, okay. And it was a massive leap, really. When I think about it now, you know, I was a youngish guy. I needed a salary, had a mortgage, with a young family. So we decided to do that. And we took the Moreno UK business and started that. And then I started Exclusive Ranges because they didn't really want to look after the other brands.
Yeah.
And so I had Rorg and...
so you bought the brands into that.
So I bought the brands into that. And so we ran both businesses together.
Right, okay.
And that went on for a while. And then Moreno were bought by Ali.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we carried on. And another real... stroke of luck, you know, bumping into the right person at the right time. Luciano Berti, he phoned me and he said, look, we're partners now, Trevor, because I owned half of the Moreno business in the UK.
Oh, okay, in the UK, right.
And he said,
okay.
you keep your half.
Yeah.
We can be partners. And then I started loading other Ali Group products into the Moreno business.
Yeah.
We carried on like this for quite a while. And then the Exclusive Ranges business was growing.
Yeah.
And we... in the end, I either had to merge the Exclusive Ranges business into the Ali thing and work for Ali, or...
sort of break away.
Break away. And I broke away and took the Ambac brand. Right. And that's how we became the Ambac dealer in the UK.
Okay. Right.
And we had that for 7 or 8 years.
And then Moreno broke off and
exactly.
And to
I had
Dawson
to, I had to give Moreno up to Dawson.
Yeah, to Dawson.
And so that was the deal. And they were super generous to me.
Yeah.
And it was a brilliant way of exiting and going on my own. It took me up to another step.
I know you still have a good relationship with Ali now. I mean,
yeah, I do. Yeah. They allowed me to have bigger premises, more people. They took on some liabilities for a few years to help me. It was a brilliant thing to do.
Yeah.
I only have great things to say about those people.
Okay.
They were great.
So, I mean, Exclusive Ranges, it caters for some of the best venues in the UK, I think it's fair to say. Can you tell us about the brands in your business now? So and maybe a couple of projects that you've installed historically?
So a couple of years ago, probably 2 years ago, you know, I looked at the business and, you know, we were predominantly cooking equipment business. And we had transitioned from being a supplier of predominantly gas equipment, which was really the marketplace, you know,
right, okay.
10 or 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And I looked at... you know, looked at that and I thought, you know, when you look across Europe and, you know, you've got to go and look what's happening in other countries. The transition from gas to electric in this country has been the biggest change.
Yeah.
If you said to me, what's the biggest change in the last 10 years?
Yeah, it's changed from...
It's a fuel change.
Yeah.
And then all the things that come with that, but... we
unfortunately some of our infrastructure is still trying to catch up
that's a challenge but it, as a principle and as an intention
that's the
direction of travel that's definitely how that's working. And we looked at lots of different products around the world, particularly induction product, and we started a relationship with Menu System in a slow way, and that has grown over the last 13 years.
Okay.
And you know, they were the leaders. They still are. You know, they were easily the best product. When I went looking, there was no question technically.
For electric and
induction cooking.
Yeah, okay.
They were absolutely the experts.
Yeah.
And it took a while to build that into our business and move away. And once we did that...
educate people,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a marketplace thing, really. And once we did that, then you change slightly how we looked at the whole business, because we're looking then for complementary product, which is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So all the product, it might be in slightly different arenas now, and it's not just cooking equipment, but it's all complementary. So we have some multi-cooking, we have some blast chilling, we have some ventilation, and all of those things wrap around the quality level you need in terms of performance and what people are looking for in terms of building a whole environment.
A complete solution.
Yes.
Yeah.
And over the last couple of years, with the growth of the menu system business, the Vianen extraction business, the Jeeper multi-cooker business, the Norman blast chiller business, all of these things are at different stages within our organization.
Yeah.
So these brands take time and patience to get into the market.
And develop. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. You know, and so the messaging is constant. You think people have got the message and they understand what you're doing and what you're able to provide.
Mm.
It's not. It's really, I mean, I still get people ringing me saying, are you still doing Moreno, Trevor? You know, we haven't done Moreno for like 12 years.
Well,
but it does happen. I don't mind. Mm. You know, we were really associated. I was really associated with the beginning of that brand.
Yeah.
And the Ambac brand, same thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just point people in the right direction.
Yeah,
of course.
Because you do quite a lot of demonstrations as well, don't you? Which is quite unique, really. Obviously, there's one big brand that does a lot of demos, but you're doing quite a lot, really.
Things that we've changed about the business and are probably going slightly against the market movement is that we want to keep things like the demos and the videoing of how things work in-house.
Yeah.
You know, we want to be controlling that in terms of how we present the brands. The other thing, actually, is controlling our spare parts and our service. You know, and we look at that business now, and it's a whole business for us. Mm. You know, we are a really big spare parts and service business for our own brands.
Right.
And we still look after some of the older brands that we've had. And keeping all of that in-house rather than going to a third-party provider it has been something that I've really felt is a massive advantage for us. We control that from end to end.
I imagine your customers and distributors quite like that.
They like it. Two things about it these days is they like that we do it, and you're dealing with the manufacturer and the supplier. Yeah. And also, it has a price impact.
Yeah, of course.
You know, but we need to get better. We need to be more technical in terms of how we allow people to access those parts, because the third party providers have got fantastic systems in place, you know.
Mm.
You know, in terms of how they distribute parts around the country, how they manage their ordering process, how the website ordering works. And we need to be better at that.
Yeah.
And for us as a business, you know, that is our, you know, one of our little target things to be doing in the next year or so.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of horses for courses, isn't it? Because some people want that one-stop shop. Some people want that more specialised approach. So
I think particularly with the induction cooking, it's a slightly more specialist approach to that. And I think definitely that it pays everybody to be doing doing all of that yourself.
Yeah. So just picking up on one of your brands, something that I'm seeing a lot and just wanted to get your sort of take on it, multi-cooking, multifunctional devices. How do you see that in the market?
So we have started working with a company called Jeeper.
Yeah.
In Czech Republic, that make multifunctional cookers, brat pans, pressure brat pans. You know, that is their specialism.
Right.
And we've started working in the UK with them. Look, we're up against one of the biggest brands in the world.
Yeah, of course.
We understand that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're small for that. But as a principle in the kitchen environment today, the growth of that type of product is going to be as big a change as bringing combination ovens was into the kitchen. It will continue to grow, and people will start getting used to using less pans, more multifunctional cooking, being able to cook overnight, being able to use a really flexible system within a kitchen. And one of, I'm going to say, like, my thought process is as to how our business might progress, or the best way our business will progress, is around some of that. Because traditionally, cook lines, cooking equipment, traditional horizontal cooking equipment, there would have been more of it. You know, so Tim would have bought big cookers, and now people are buying slightly smaller cookers.
Yeah, to reduce the footprint.
To reduce footprint, reduce energy, reduce the space they need to actually, and then use a product that can do more than one thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, from a purely from a commercial point of view, rather than even a market point of view, as exclusive ranges, were saying, well, okay, people buying smaller cookers, we're selling smaller cookers, you know, and that's what we're going to be asked for. So to have a complementary group of product around that
makes sense.
Is really is really our direction of travel.
So what sets exclusive ranges against other manufacturers? I mean, effectively, I know you bring the product, effectively you're a manufacturer, against other products in the industry, what's your USP really?
I think if you look at the brand individually, then you could say from a technology point of view, we are at the very top end and at the very forefront of that, not just with the cooking, but with the Vianen. The Vianen business has changed our business hugely.
Right.
It's been something that we...
The extraction system.
The extraction systems. That a lot of people might listen to this and go, what does Trevor Burke know about extraction systems? He's a cook salesman. That would be a point.
Yeah.
But we'd worked with the Vianen family for many years.
Okay.
Helping them and doing some of our own work with their extraction canopies. And they were brilliantly helpful to us.
But to be fair, you did also recruit a master in extraction in the business.
When we took Vianen on, and the Vianen product is amazing, and they had withdrawn a little bit from the UK, and they used us for doing things for them to help them out, and we did. And they wanted to kind of re-engage with the UK market formally, and so they asked us. And we went backwards and forwards a little bit because I wasn't really sure whether our business could incorporate that.
Yeah.
And but in the end, we just said, yes, okay, we'll give that a go. And I can remember talking to the family and Harry and Ruth, who were the founders, and Lisa, the daughter who's running it now. And Lisa is one of the smartest women I've met in my whole time dealing with factories. I mean, she is amazing. And she said, you're going to be busy straight away with this.
Oh, right. Okay.
I said, oh, really? I said, but you... And I'm like, you've not really been here for 10 years. He said, no. She said, we're a worldwide brand. And I was like, oh, wow, okay. We announced it. We did a very small thing at HRC, put a canopy up, put some signage up, went on LinkedIn. That was it, really. We were inundated.
Seriously?
Straight away.
Wow, okay.
From people that we wouldn't normally deal with.
Yeah.
You know, M&E contractors, more M&E consultants, the traditional consultant and distributor business. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, so I need to find somebody. So we went and found a guy called Paul Crumpler, who's like a small legend in the ventilation business.
Exactly.
And Paul as...
very well respected.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Paul... He's running that Vianen business now for us, and it's going to be a huge success. I've no doubt in my mind, and part of their success is the technology element. Right. You know, lots of people make canopies here at various levels, but high end technology, energy saving, energy management is a massive thing for the Vianen brand, and Paul understands all of that, and so I think So as a business, you know, we try to incorporate product that really are the top end of each different sector area, whether we're multi-cooking, whether we're induction cooking, whether we're ventilation. We want all of the product to be at the right level.
Yeah.
That, you know, whatever brand we introduce or look at, we just ask ourselves that question.
Yeah.
And say, whereabouts do we position this in the market? Because over the years, it would have been quite straightforward, frankly, to bring in a lower level cooking brand, for example.
Yeah, which has got its market.
Absolutely. But, you know, are we in that market? Is that what we really do? Is that what we're really known for? Probably not.
Yeah.
We are known for operating at that
higher level. Your name kind of says it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Exclusive ranges. Yeah. So,
you know, I think... That's where we are. I think we need to do more and explain to people that we are not just a cooking equipment company now.
Yeah.
You know, we're a broader company. We have a broader offer.
Yeah.
And I think that's our our job.
Can you tell me a little bit about your role within the FEA, so the Food Service Equipment Association? I believe you sit on the board.
Yes.
Yeah, a bit of your role. And
so I came to all of that quite late, actually. Right. And Keith Warren, who was the guy that ran that.
Yeah.
And I've known Keith for many, many years. And I'd always been a member, you know, and I always... I've always been, before it was the FEA, it was CESA, and we were, as a business, we were members, mm-hmm. because of the technical backup, the information sharing is of great help to a small import business,
yeah.
from a technology point of view and from a legislative point of view. And so I'd always, been part of that. And I remember Keith saying, well, why don't you come and get involved a bit more? And it wasn't that long ago, really. And I thought, well, yeah, okay. And got voted on to the board and the committee. I still do sit on a couple of the committees. Mm-hmm. And I found it hugely beneficial.
Right.
And enjoyable. I mean, and I really, really regret not doing it earlier.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, you can progress up and do different things within that organization. And, you know, now I'm 62 years old, you know, the profile needs to be like of younger people coming into the industry, which we promote.
Yeah.
You know, as sort of guys who've been doing it a little while and are a bit older, and we push that forward, whether it's female members. And it's a thing, you know, it was really male orientated. And we've changed a lot of that. And we have some really, really active and smart female members.
You have a female chair.
And we're next chair's a female chair.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And so, you know, my time's going to come to an end, you know, eventually. and that's great. But I really regret not doing it earlier.
Yeah.
Should have started way earlier.
So a little plug, we're actually going to be interviewing Emma
at
the FEA conference.
Oh, she's great.
In November?
Yeah.
Live, so that'll be a great one coming up. So just to wrap us up quickly, is there any specific innovations or projects coming up you want to share with us?
You know, we're constantly doing nice work. I mean, that's really part of how we are. I mean, whether it's for Tim and... some of the projects we've done for him, or you know, we've just done a huge thing at Kensington Roof Garden,
right? Okay.
Which is a re-emergence of that. It's an amazing facility. All of our product, a lot of extraction canopies, cookers, and it's a great project. But we kind of don't go in for that. This is a great job. We probably should promote that a little bit more. But the best thing for me is that, you know, not just because he's here, but the constant involvement with whether it's Tim's business or doing three kitchens for the Roof family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And going there at the very end on the last couple of days as a guest, as a thank you.
That's an accolade, isn't it?
For dealing with those things. Or, you know, and we did the basement of the Ritz with menu system 10 years ago, took the gas out of that kitchen, and everyone thought it was amazing because it was old raw granules that I put in there.
Yeah.
And we took all of that gas out. We put menu systems, electric cookers in there. We showed them about the energy. We showed them about the environment. And John Williams was like, okay, this is the way we're going. And we did all of that. And so that has been there for 10 years. Looks amazing. But now we're going to be involved in the refurbishment of that, of the Ritz. And so John and the boys just say, look, we're going with that again. Well, we're going to have the new stuff. You know, this is what we do. This is how we work.
Yeah.
And so that longevity with these kind of, you know, we did
stuff
with the Maybourne Group, Claridge's and the Connell. Again, old raw granges 25 years later, I've taken them out and put in new menu systems cookers. All of those things for me are the things we're most proud of.
Yeah.
In terms of that we get asked back.
Hmm.
You know, we might do amazing one-off jobs and they're great.
Yeah.
But the thing that keeps rolling us along with in the area of business that we're in is that we're asked to go back and do it again.
Yeah. Speaks for itself, really, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. And it's a testament to the product and
your service
to the people in the business, you know, the people who run the service and look after that. Because it's not me every day, it's Jane, you know, frankly, who runs our service desk. Mm. And, you know, God forbid I have to take the service phone when she's on holiday. He said, you know, but, so nowadays, if I pick that phone up,
yeah,
with Jane's away maybe and I'm covering, they're like, where's Jane?
She's so trusted.
So no, they're the things we're more focused on, that we're more proud of. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Trevor, thank you so much for taking time to part of the show today, this bit. It's great to talk to you and learn a bit more about Exclusive Ranges. Also to find out that you're a footballer as you started. Didn't know that. So then now the final part of the show, we're going to be discussing innovation in the hospitality sector. So now Tim rejoins me and Trevor, and we're going to be discussing innovation in the hospitality sector. As we've got the chef director from Caprice Holdings on today's show, and they're known to be a powerhouse in innovation. So Tim, how can traditional restaurants incorporate innovation in their practices, in their everyday functions in their business?
Well, like Trevor said, you know, the technology's forever changing. When you have a restaurant, also the real estate is quite expensive now, so more space has to be taken up for covers, for tables.
Yeah.
So your kitchens are smaller, which in a way I don't mind, as long as the kitchen has the right equipment.
Yeah.
Which, like Trevor was saying, you know, you've got all these different types of ranges now, more efficient, temperatures down, atmosphere in the kitchen's better, and it's a lot more easier to push out our covers. And whatever comes new on the market, I'm always looking and having a look. I said I have a fight with Trev quite a lot because he likes to give me too much technology on a piece of kit. And I said, my chefs don't like pressing all these buttons, you know. They just want to turn it on, turn it off, keep it simple, because all they do is press the button and break it. And then I get upset with them.
Yeah.
So I'm all for all things which are all modernized and new and makes basically the chef's life a lot easier.
Yeah.
And a better atmosphere in the kitchen.
So kind of looking at equipment really for innovation and the spaces, the layouts, the kitchens.
Yeah, your kitchen equipment is one of the most important things, you know.
Yeah.
If you can save time on anything, it's just helps the day.
True. Trevor, what would you say is the most innovative concept that you've seen in the hospitality sector? Obviously, I know we've got Tim here, but just say what you like. And
I think that we look at different parts of the industry.
Yeah.
You know, we look at the Tim's world in terms of that high end, and that really covers, you know, a combination of traditional cooking and traditional operation with, and I think where the biggest change has been is in probably cooking in volume.
Right. Okay.
For me, where, you know, the competition between like multifunctional cooking, for example, whether it's us or any of the others, it's not necessarily us. It's doing it traditionally.
Yeah.
So in traditional times, you know, the big change has been, you know, you might have had whether it's in a college or a university or a contract catering environment, you would have had lots of different product, lots of different atmospheric product where you're cooking, you know, over long periods of time with quite a lot of energy. That has changed completely.
Okay.
You know, so all you're doing now is shifting away from large volume bulk cooking into high performance bulk cooking with lots less energy, lots less water consumption, lots less space, lots less extraction requirements. So that for me is where that innovation is, that change is. You know, you look at some of the designs that consultants are putting into the marketplace now, you know, you think, crikey, there's not that much equipment on there.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's all high performance.
It's all multifunctional.
Exactly, running there 24 hours.
Yeah.
You can put the lid down, put it under pressure, work overnight. It's a different business.
I think it started with rationales, really.
That sort of
revolutionized a lot of the kitchen, where you had this sudden oven that could do steam, roast, slow cooking, everything. And we also got rid of a lot of the gas ovens that used to be on underneath the cooker.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you're not bending down anymore.
No.
I've just got rid of every oven out of a suite and just purely use rationale.
I just use rationale.
Yeah, because they're just so good.
I mean, they are. Yeah, that's
wonderfully made. Yeah. I mean, German technology at its best. I mean, they make great cars, they make great ovens.
This is true. Yeah, really true. I mean, I know we touched on it before a little bit, but what's the most effective strategy leads you to adapting to unexpected changes? I mean, I think we can obviously think about COVID, Brexit, you know. Trevor, do you want to?
I think for us, the pace of change in our end of the business, in the equipment supply end or the kitchen, is incremental. It's slightly slower.
Right.
You know, and what you do see then is, I always feel, and we found twice now in my career, where when I started selling raw ranges, people used to say to me, well, we sold them to Conran, and, you know, and they'd say, well, you're only going to sell four or five of those a year. No one else can afford them. And so it's top down. And in the end, we sold 30 a year.
Mm.
And then we changed over quite a long period from not very much change and then an accelerated change into electric. And then so when I started saying, look, induction cooking now is going to be the next
big
move, big move. People thought I was a little bit mad 15 years ago, spending so much effort and time on thinking about that.
Yeah.
But it came along, and you then get your reward, if you like, for taking a bit more of a chance on market movement. So we can see, if you're out there looking, you can see market movement, but it is quite slow. I think, but with people like Tim, when we go into the restaurant and look at what's happening inside Tim's world, even from the outside, it's much faster. You know, something like Brexit comes, and it's like more or less overnight. You're changing where you're bringing your staff from, where you can employ people from, how you've got to work with them, and I think it's way quicker on the operational side
than it is on the supply side. So Tim, I mean, have you adapted to unexpected change, like for instance Brexit and the skills change?
Yes, skill. Well, I mean, COVID and Brexit was like the perfect storm, really, for our industry. You know, we got hit very hard. Both sides, you know.
Yeah.
When you look at all the people now that regret Brexit, I remember that day it happened. A lot of the European staff thought that we had betrayed them, and as we clearly said, it's not our vote. We didn't do that vote. We all voted to stay in.
Yeah.
All the cities voted to stay in.
Hmm.
You know, it's what people are fed in the media.
Yeah, of course.
And that's what. What really
drove it.
hurt our industry, and we have had to change now. With you haven't got so many European workforce. Mm. You have more multinational. You have a lot of Indian, Pakistani, Bangladesh, Nepal, you have Filipinos anyway, because a lot of them were British born anyway.
Yeah,
but their families coming over, and you see a lot more different change in the kitchen. And we've had to adapt a lot to that as well.
Yeah.
You know, COVID is, I don't know, it seems like a little bit like a war. Everyone's come out of this COVID and they're using this as a big thing now.
Mm.
And I don't know if it's really sunk in with me that it was that much of an issue, but with the younger generation, it was a really big issue.
Yeah.
And I think we're finding out the complications of it now.
Yeah.
With how it's affected the younger generation.
Mental health and things like that.
Yeah, and we've had to adapt with that.
Yeah, definitely.
Which in our industry is we're quite slow at adapting to people's emotions.
Yeah.
So,
which is funny, isn't it? Because it's quite an emotional business in a way.
We are very emotional.
So it's a change, isn't it?
Quite cold at times. But it is, I think it is. People are changing, and it is a good thing.
Trevor, can you think of any unique dining experiences that you've experienced that are successful and maybe quite, you know, using innovation a lot?
You know, I'm pretty traditional in where I go and eat when I eat out. But we did go, we were over in Holland, actually, and with the Vianen guys, and they're near Amsterdam. They said, we're going to take you to a very special restaurant.
Right.
This evening, and they're very funny people. very humorous, and it's a really, but it's like half an hour drive, which frankly, you know, you're thinking, really, half an hour? So we drove out into the, almost in the middle of nowhere outside of Amsterdam, and pulled up in this big, really quite big building, really lovely modern building. And we go in there, and they've got a two-sided restaurant, and we sat there, and they said, the thing about this restaurant is that all of the service is robotic.
Oh, okay.
So robotic collection point. So they took us in the kitchen. The kitchen was bigger, gangways bigger, right, on the pass for these robots to...
to work.
Yeah. To go in and out, to glide in and out. And we were like, wow, okay. So, but it's a really interesting thing about the technology. It's so at the beginning, because you could only choose on one side of the menu for some things and another side of the menu from the other things, but you couldn't mix them up because it confused the robot. So the robot would come and take your order.
What about allergies?
So in the end, the food was great actually, but the service thing with the robot, and they didn't do the wine. They couldn't do the beverage, so they could only do the food. And then the food would just come with these little Dalek, robot things with your food on. But he didn't know whose food was who.
So you're
collecting rather than... So the whole experience was really quite... It was fun. But what it did show you is that, you know...
It's early days,
It's called the hospitality industry for a reason. And, you know, people are hospitable to you and you are to them. And I just felt the robot serving thing has got some way to go in terms of, like, smarter restaurants. It might be good... in some chains or fast food or very narrow menued restaurants.
Yeah.
But that was really something. And this was like, you know, quite a smart restaurant. But it did miss a little bit of what you would expect from that. But quite fun. I mean...
What was that robot series? Westworld, was it?
Oh, yeah.
So you had a complaint to the robot, and then next thing you know, he's going to kill you.
True.
So it was fun, but... It just showed you that there's some way to go with that technology.
Tim, I mean, in your business or generally, do you use things like data analytics or any information, or as you talked about, in your daily reports from your chefs to sort of drive innovation in the hospitality sector?
We do look at data. I think the clearest data you can have is by your restaurant when you've got your menu.
Yeah.
You see...
Busy, and
what people eat. And I know certain areas of London, if I'm in Mayfair, they're a different type of eater. If I'm in Richmond, they're different. And if you go to Soho, it's a different eater.
Yeah.
So you can have all the data in the world you want. You just really, really need to know your marketplace. You need to know where you're at. You need to know where you are. I always say to a chef, you know, young chef, you know, when he does a menu now, I said, if you do the food you like to eat, you'll have an empty restaurant. You have to have a mix.
Okay.
You have to have people that are familiar with what they like to eat.
Yeah.
And then you can do your little bit of stardust menu, you know, your like 6 or 7 dishes, which are amazing. But then you need some dishes that people know,
that
are familiar with.
Yeah,
that is a successful restaurant, I think.
Favorites, and they stay there all the time.
Exactly. So data. I think sometimes we get wrapped up with too much data.
Yeah.
It's like Trevor said before, it's hospitality industry.
Yeah.
It's about being hospitable, getting the people in, chatting to them, talking to them, knowing a bit about them, you know what they like. Nobody comes in, right, he likes the FT, give him the FT straight away. Bottle of water, have a little chat.
You're
engaging.
It's a good point, really. And it's about experience, isn't it? They say knowing your business and your customer.
I mean, sure, you do need data, as in, you know, what was your peak time of people booking?
Yeah.
How many calls you're missing? Why are you missing so many calls? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because that's good data.
Do you see those sort of trends with sort of, if you looked at July last year and then this year?
Yeah, always. We always do like for like. Yeah, we do week for week, prior week, this week.
Okay.
Like for like last year.
Right.
So you can track where you're at.
And see if there's any peaks or troughs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right, okay.
Spend per head, you know, spend per head's down now. Why is it? You know, in January, you know, your spend per head goes right down because it's dry January.
Yeah.
And you know, you just see these sort of trends.
Yeah. Okay. So just picking up on what Tim was saying about sort of trends, do you see any future trends in the hospitality sector coming up? And how can those businesses prepare for it?
I think if you look at that direction of travel, I think that, you know, I was talking to Tim about this morning, and over our period in the industry, we've seen lots of big restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, from back in the day with the big Conrad Brasseries and some of the
really big footprint.
Really big footprint restaurants. And that's something that you don't see now. You very rarely see that. Today.
No, true.
And, you know, if someone said, well, you know, we've got lots of money, we want to invest in the hospitality industry, I'd say, well, you know, maybe invest in a Premiership football team might be easier. But, you know, we're not seeing the really big, full on operations that we used to see in the past. We're seeing smaller and a little bit more intimate. We've also seen a couple of the slightly higher end. Not chains really, but just groups, you know, 20 restaurants, looking at how they model their model in the sense of saying they go for a specific site that's got a specific number attached to it, that has got a specific bar take attached to it, and, for example, might incorporate rooms now. So to be able to make a return on that investment, that they are very tight in terms of how they do it.
Yeah,
it's a repeatable model in a repeatable size site, and that will include maybe a restaurant operation, a bar operation, and a room offer. Anything between 10 and 20 rooms.
Right, okay.
So we listened to a guy who gave a presentation about that quite recently at a conference, and I thought, yeah, it's quite interesting how they want to make the numbers work.
Yeah.
How people are looking at operations and thinking, right, okay.
It's a bit more diverse as opposed to size.
As opposed to saying, let's just have a massive, great big restaurant and try and fill it up. Because Tim will know. Tim will say,
if that's empty, you won't go.
You're dead in water.
Yeah.
And whereas if you've got a smaller operation with a bar that's being treated a bit like a pub and with rooms where you've got people coming down for dinner or coming in for a drink, you know, you've got a much more mobile dynamic there.
Yeah.
And I think that you see investment in that arena rather than someone saying, I'm just going to open a 250-seat restaurant here.
Yeah, and
see
how that goes.
Yeah, you know, I think those days are probably gone for a while.
And so in contrast, Tim, and by curiosity, is there any innovation that you think just is not going to work? And obviously we touched on the robots.
I often say, God, I wish I had some robots to do this job. But now, seeing Trevor's experience, maybe not.
Yeah.
I think a lot of chefs now are getting, you know, they find easier ways to do things. What their number one cost is labor.
Yeah.
So what they have to do is come up with different ideas of how they operate.
So how they staff it.
Staffing it, you know, innovation. If there's anything new out there on the market, they'll try and find that and come up with it. And then us as chefs, what we do, we all copy each other. So it takes one person to come up with a bright idea and then suddenly everyone else copies and rejigs it around a little bit to work for their sort of their establishment.
Yeah.
But it's hard to come up, you know, you come up with a great idea and lucky you know.
true,
but not true. Robots.
No.
Not yet.
Okay, fair enough. So Tim, as addition in this series, the guest of the current episode asked the question to the guest of the next episode. Now, I know you know who's coming on the next show. Mm-hmm. What question have you got lined up for him?
Well, as from his background, I mean, I'm seeing now a lot more Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshian chefs coming into our restaurants.
Yeah.
And I'd like to ask him the question, does he think that they will embrace the classical cuisine and then one day they'll be leaders in sort of like more French, Italian style cuisine with their culture's seasoning, spicing?
Okay.
To
some more fusion.
To come up with a new style of cuisine.
Right, okay.
Like when we saw the fusion cuisine, which was the Asian and the European cuisine. Will we see a more Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi style fusion. French cuisine-y type things, because the French don't embrace too much of that cuisine. So that's my question to him.
Okay, well, I'll pose that question to him. We'll see what he has to say. So, Tim and Trevor, thank you so much for being part of the show. I hope you've both enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's been great.
Great.
Really enjoyed it.
It's been a real pleasure to have you on. And that concludes this episode of Kitchen Curiosity. It's been fantastic to hear from Tim Hughes at Caprice and Trevor Burke's career in the sector and the fantastic brands and exclusive ranges. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. If you've got any questions or you'd like to ask future guests, please pop me an email at radford@kitchencuriosity.co.uk. On the next episode, we're still going to be up in London and we're interviewing a famous celebrity chef who most of you should know. He's a well-known Indian master chef, proprietor of the famous Cafe Spice. He began his journey in the UK in 1991 when his family opened his first restaurant, and by 2000, he was awarded an MBE. And in 2009... he was awarded a further OBE. Also on the show, we have an award-winning global leading manufacturer supplier of professional catering equipment. I'm joined by their national sales manager, who's worked in the catering industry since the age of 16 and working for a major chain. And then he started his career in the Royal Air Force. And since 2008, he's been in the catering equipment sector. Click subscribe to follow us. If you've got a moment, please rate us on our podcast and don't miss out on the next episode coming on the 2nd of September. I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.